All right, we are going to begin. I recognize people are still coming in. If you'd come in quietly, quickly find a seat. We have some rows that are open up here and even in front here, but we do want to begin. So good evening, colleagues, students, friends, and supporters of Eastern Mennonite University. I am Susan Schultz-Huxman, president of EMU, and we are so glad that you are here to mark our first annual Academic and Creative Excellence Festival. And somehow we got great weather today to launch it. The Academic and Creative Excellence Festival is also known as ACE. I love that acronym. That's an acronym that really packs a punch, and it matters. And it matters because we have many ACE scholars at EMU in both the student body and faculty ranks. This 2.5-day festival, April 18th through the 20th, will showcase, by my count, 344 scholarly and creative works by our students and faculty. Wow, that is impressive. And remember, it is a festival, not just a conference. And that means it is designed to be fun and engaging and even interactive. And yes, we canceled class for tomorrow to add to the fun. The ACE Festival is designed to accomplish several goals: to recognize excellence in research at EMU, to raise the visibility of the diversity of scholarship that goes on every year at EMU, including academic and creative, theoretical and applied, critical and experimental, discursive and non-discursive, and to validate liberal arts education, to examine the rigor, relevance, impact, and interdisciplinary richness of research that pulsates from our liberal arts fields here at EMU in the humanities, fine arts, social sciences, professional schools, and STEM disciplines. And in a larger sense, the ACE Festival is a powerful way to make manifest our mission. Our mission at EMU is to prepare students to serve and lead in a global context. Our community of learning integrates Christian faith, academic rigor, artistic creation, and reflective practice informed by the liberal arts, interdisciplinary engagement, and cross-cultural encounter. The ACE Festival is also a compelling way to mark our centennial celebrations. Scholarly inquiry of all kinds was important at EMU right from its inception in 1917. Yes, biblical and literary exegesis was performed right alongside the science of soil cultivation and the artistic expression of choral music. In the intervening 100 years, we've been on quite a trajectory, stacking up state, regional, and national accolades and recognition for our superb academic accomplishments and student outcomes and placements at both the graduate and undergraduate levels. This year alone, EMU has won national recognition in engineering, biochemistry, mathematics, nursing, counseling, and photography, just to name a few. The ACE Festival also underscores two goals of our strategic plan for 2017 to 2022: celebrate and engage. Together, we aim to celebrate our distinctive education that transforms lives. And together, we aim to engage more intentionally students, faculty, staff, and alumni with a community of learning local and globally, as together we embark on transformative learning for our second century. I want to say a special thank you to the ACE team, the visionaries, planners, promoters, and participants who for years have been waiting for this day. I know Kirsten will mention this a little bit more, but I want to say, too, hats off to you, to folks like Kirsten and Diane and the Intellectual Life Committee. And I want to offer a shout out of appreciation to our sponsors, Martin Beachy and Earhart, Certified Public Accountants, Secure Futures, Solar Power and Services in Virginia, and ACRS, Anabaptist Center for Religion and Society. Finally, a key feature of any high-end academic conference and festival is attracting a rock star scholar who exemplifies the kind of research that we aspire to conduct at EMU. While she will receive a more formal introduction shortly, I want to say, Professor Fania Davis, we are delighted that you are here. We are delighted that you are here to share with us how your academic and judicial expertise informs your highly acclaimed restorative justice scholarship and bold social justice activism. To close, I would remind you of the words of two acclaimed scholars, one in the sciences and one in the arts and social sciences. Both maintained that their scholarly legacy was the result of one very powerful thing: curiosity, relentless curiosity. One said, "I'm neither clever nor specially gifted. I am only very curious." That scholar was Albert Einstein. The other said, "Research is a formalized curiosity. It is poking and prying with a purpose." That scholar was Zora Neale Hurston, the American novelist and anthropologist who poked and prodded and pried about issues of race and culture her entire professional life. So let's enjoy the ACE Festival, everyone, and stay curious. Thank you.
Good evening. I'm Kirsten Beachy, here speaking for the Intellectual Life Committee. This festival is our gift to each other at the end of a long school year. It's a chance to share what we've been working on with each other, students and faculty alike. And many of you have been working and rushing and practicing to get things together, posters to hang, papers to present. And we're grateful for your work and looking forward to appreciating it tomorrow. By the numbers at my last count, which is probably wrong by now, we had 67 students involved in oral presentations, 107 involved in poster presentations, artwork and performances from more than 70 students, 25 professors sharing their published works. I'm here for the housekeeping. I need to say thank you to many people, to give a brief program update, and then share just a few notes about attending an academic conference. So first of all, thank you in particular to Laura Daly and Emily North for attending to various details of this conference. And to Barbara yes, let's clap. And to Barbara Beyer for her energetic work to make arrangements for Dr. Davis's visit, along with the entire Fellowship Planning Committee members, Miriam Aziz, Devante Dews, Katrina Poplett, Meg Sander, John Swartz, and Brittany Williams. So to Barbara and the committee. And to Diane Farrar, who worked tireless hours to bring this festival schedule and the details together. You've received many emails from her. She is at home resting up for tomorrow, so please share your gratitude with her when you see her next. And thanks also to the entire Intellectual Life Committee over several different years for helping with visioning over time, and particularly for Tara Kishbaugh and Fred Niss, who really have championed this idea for years. So one more round of applause. And And we also want to acknowledge the Council of Independent Colleges and Universities Woodrow Wilson Fellows Program, which facilitated Dr. Fania E. Davis's week-long residency here, and which many of us have already benefited from. I have a program update. If you look in your flyer at the very end of Thursday's activities, you can pencil something in. 7:30 tomorrow night, there is a drum workshop with Dr. Ram Bhagat of Drums No Guns, and Dr. Davis is planning to join the circle. It's going to be held on Thomas Plaza if weather permits, or in the Discipleship Center if it is not. It should be a wonderful event. And if you're feeling torn between attending that or going to the Main Stage Theater production, know that you may go to the Main Stage Theater production on Friday and Saturday nights also. Following tonight's keynote address, there will be a reception in the Campus Center for Dr. Davis. Please give her the opportunity to walk over to the Campus Center before you greet her. And finally, just a few notes, particularly for those of you for whom this may be your very first academic conference. This is an academic conference with bonus. It's a creative arts festival as well. So we have scholarly opportunities, chances to enjoy the arts. But this is a short guide on how to conference in 5 points. So number one, go to the keynote. Yay, you are here. It provides common ground for all conference participants. And in this case, it also culminates our campus discussions of our common read for this year, Ta-Nehisi Coates, Between the World and Me. Number two, study the schedule. Thursday's events are accessible in several forms. The flyer you picked up on your way in has a schedule overview. On the website, you can find the schedule in long form. You may also find a short form grid, which is particularly useful for looking at all of the different overlapping events. And you can go through that and pick out the things that you most want to go to. And this is what happens at an academic conference. All of the things you want to go to are at the same time, and you will just have to prioritize. Number three, take the opportunity to network. Breaks are built in, so eat snacks, talk to people. Number four, bring your ID, sign in. This counts as your conference badge. And faculty and staff, please also sign in. It's going to be really helpful for us in planning for future conferences to know who was where or how many people were in which places. Scanning will be available at the beginning of all presentation sessions and throughout the poster sessions. Finally, number five, please tell us how it went. Watch for an evaluation form next week, and that will help us in planning for the future again. And then two etiquette notes. Please, tomorrow, wait to enter or exit a room until a transition between presentations. And likewise, to help your presenters, please minimize cell phone usage. And I'm turning mine off right now. Again, so as not to distract presenters. And I will now leave the stage and invite EMU senior Devante Dews, co-leader of the Black Student Union, biology major, and known to many of you for his many other roles and achievements on campus, to introduce our keynote speaker for the evening. Thank you.
Good evening. I would like to give God glory just for this prestigious opportunity to introduce one of the most well-known foot soldiers of the civil rights movement and in the field of restorative justice. With my short time with her, I was able to truly see her passion for social change. After hearing her story, it has brought true hope and healing for myself and the dreams that I have for EMU and the world. I hope as we listen to Dr. Fania Davis, you will receive the same spark of hope and flame that she has brought into me. As we listen to her, I challenge you to reflect on your own morals and what are you doing for the social change in the world. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Devante. Thank all of you for being here today. Thank the organizers of this event and the president and the mayor of Harrisonburg, I understand, is here. And all of you, I'm truly honored. Thank you for inviting me to spend an entire week here in this beautiful place, the Shenandoah Valley. I've been visiting classrooms, I've been sharing meals together with many of you, I've been hearing your stories and sharing mine. How many of you have been in a classroom or at a lunch or dinner with me? Wow, okay. As you can see, Kristen has kept me very, very busy. I also wish to acknowledge the ancestors of this beautiful land, the Siouans, the Catawbas, the Shawnee, the Delaware, the Cherokee, the Susquehannocks, the Iroquois Nation, and others. In invoking the ancestors of this land, we acknowledge this is an occupied land upon which we stand. This is a land that is the historic site of genocide, the ultimate harm that one can do to a people. And like the original harms of slavery and white supremacy, we have yet as a nation to tell the whole truth about this genocide, to own it, to take responsibility for it, to make reparations for it, and to engage in a collective, restorative, justice-based healing process. And when I say reparations, look at the range of reparative action Germany has taken to transform the massive harm of the Holocaust. Germany is actually modeling what we in this country can do to step up to the plate. We are a nation birthed in appalling terror and trauma, congenital wounds from which we have yet to heal. And because we have not yet healed, the original trauma perpetually reenacts itself, albeit in different guises. Yes, slavery is abolished in the 19th century, but it morphs into convict leasing. It morphs into peonage, and then into lynching, and then into Jim Crow. And after we got rid of Jim Crow, today it has morphed into mass incarceration, police killings, and the school-to-prison pipeline. It is dawning upon us that until we as a nation engage in a collective truth-telling, reparative justice, and healing process to interrupt historical harm and trauma, we are doomed to perpetually reenact them. Many of you at EMU that I met and that are in this room, I imagine, today, are training to be restorative justice practitioners, to be trauma healers, to be strategic peace builders. Your skills are sorely needed for this historical task. I want to offer a praise song to EMU. I won't injure your ears by actually singing tonight. We'll keep the praise song metaphorical. As I've said several times in class presentations and other meetings this week, EMU has a special place in my heart for a few reasons. One, it is the international citadel, the academic citadel of restorative justice. It is the home of the Zaire Institute, with Howard Zaire, of course, being the grandfather of contemporary restorative justice. EMU-CJP is also an acclaimed international academic center in the fields of peace building and conflict transformation. And because EMU is so highly regarded around the world for these reasons, it has many international students. And I just love the diversity of EMU nationality and geography. It's like a mini UN. You know, there's a sign at the entrance of the campus center that expresses my feelings. Do you know the sign I'm talking about? It says, I love EMU. And that's why I allow only EMU, and only at EMU will I allow them to run me ragged in the way that, that Kirsten has been, out of my love for you. Yeah. If we're to move into a future, history is calling upon us to become more skilled as healers and as peace builders and as justice activists, all of those. Though growth areas remain in the area of racial justice, I want to thank EMU for answering this call of history. So tonight I want to share with you, I was asked actually by Kristen, to share with you my thoughts about the Ta-Nehisi book, Between the World and Me. How many of you have actually read that? Okay, a good number. I hope more of you end up reading it. I understand you've been reading it in classes and at gatherings, and faculty has been reading it. Chapel talks have been focused on that subject. So tonight I'll summarize the book. I'll note its nearly unprecedented success and offer reflections based on my particular life experience. As a lifelong restorative justice, practitioner, but a lifelong racial justice activist, only in later life, as an elder, did I come to restorative justice and to indigenous worldviews. But the point is that I will offer a sort of analysis based on those perspectives. Between the World and Me is styled as Ta-Nehisi Coates' letter to his 15-year-old son, written in the wake of the incessant state-sanctioned assault against Black people. I don't need to give you a long list of the names. Many of you, all of you probably know quite a long list already. Coates tells his son that America has created a dream and an empire based on the socially constructed notion of race. In order to build up this most powerful empire in human history, and in the name of the falsehood of race, Black bodies have been terrorized, dehumanized, demonized, and criminalized, from slavery to convict leasing, from lynching to Jim Crow, and today it continues through police killings and mass incarcerations. The book opens with these words. Son, last Sunday, the host of a popular news show asked me what it means to lose my body. Indeed, all of the pages that follow address the question of what it means to inhabit a Black male body in America. One could indeed say that the book is a brilliantly written meditation on the Black male body. Its trials, its tribulations, its tortures, its terrors, its traumas, and its travails. It's a book about how the plunder of the Black body has fueled the white dream. That is the book's theme. Coates disdains spirituality. He says, and I quote, I believe and believed and still do that our bodies are ourselves, that my soul is the voltage conducted through my neurons and nerves, and that my spirit is flesh. So, as you can see, he believes the body is all there is. Only it is real. And he says, and I quote, I have no praise anthems, nor old Negro spirituals. The spirit and soul are the body and brain, which are destructible, and that is precisely why they are so precious. Coates further tells his son, here is what I would like for you to know, and I quote, in America, it is traditional to destroy the Black body. It indeed is heritage. And I just want to pause there because that's That's a very profound act of truth-telling. It is traditional in America to destroy the black body. It is heritage. Fear, shaping much of Coates' sense of himself in the world, is another theme of the book. When I was your age, Coates writes to his son, the only people I knew were black, and all of them were powerfully, adamantly, dangerously afraid. Afraid either of the white power structure or of violence in the streets. Coates expresses little hope for the future. Racism is permanent, he seems to say. It will always be the reality. He says to his son, I quote, "We are captured, brother, surrounded by the majoritarian bandits of America. And this has happened here in our only home. And the terrible truth is that we cannot will ourselves to an escape on our own." And for him, spirituality and activism offer a false hope. As I utter these words, I feel constricted in my body. To think about and reflect upon what he is saying is very moving and very powerful, and for me, very distressing. Let's address the impact of this book. The success of this book was nearly unprecedented. Toni Morrison hailed Coates as the new James Baldwin in her blurb for the book. Someone said that Toni Morrison is like God. So to receive this review is divine. Coates also received the National Book Award for Nonfiction and was a finalist for the Pulitzer. He received a MacArthur Genius Award after the publication of the book. It is one of the most widely reviewed and widely taught books in the nation. Coates has been lionized as the best writer on the subject of race. Can you hear me when I walk away? Yeah, well, good. Yep, there we go. Now to my reviews. They're mixed. Let's start with the four things that I appreciate. First, there is Coates' unique voice as a public intellectual. As Michelle Alexander says, and I quote, "Coates' voice stands nearly alone. A black man raised in the streets of Baltimore who narrowly escaped the violence that lurked around every corner and dodged the clutches of the prisons and jails that were built for him, and who now speaks unpopular, unconventional, and sometimes even radical truths in his own voice." So this is a brother whose voice has historically been silenced, who is now a leading public intellectual. And I admire that. His voice is bursting forth with great impact. Toni Morrison's comparison to Baldwin resonates for me in one way, and that is that both Baldwin and Coates are just amazing writers. Did you find that with Coates? Yeah? Yes? They both write exquisitely and poetically and powerfully. And of course, Coates writes in the hip-hop music and cultural tradition. He came of age during that era. On the other side, Baldwin came of age in the black church. His father was a minister. So while they're both masters of their craft, the formative experiences of each could not have been more different. While Coates emphasizes that only matter is real, only the body exists, Baldwin, emerging from a Black Baptist and liberation theology tradition, has had the lived experience of transcendence, of feeling the spirit move through his body. His father, as I said, was a minister. And he writes about a lot of these sort of transcendent experiences. that he has personally had. In addition to appreciating Coates' mastery of the written word, I appreciate his beats, his riffs about, quote, people who believe themselves to be white. Did that strike you, the ones who have read, the people who believe themselves to be white? In using this language, he is popularizing the scientific notion that race is a falsehood. Some of you may have not known that until you read this book, and I appreciate that about this book. He is making the point that race has no biological nor genetic basis. Race is a lie. We deliberately constructed this pseudoscientific notion to justify slavery's unspeakable terrors and to legitimate white supremacy. Before the 1500s, people were not known as black or white. They didn't exist. Race is a modern invention. Race is not real, but racism is very real. Coates says, race is a child of racism, not the father. On a related note, I appreciate that Coates' book as a whole powerfully drives home the truth that racism is not an aberration. It is not an anomaly. It is the usual way we conduct business in this nation. It is a common, everyday experience of people of color. The historical and contemporary coupling of U.S. liberal democracy with racism is not anomalous. It is symbiotic. You cannot have one without the other. You cannot have American democracy without racism. That's just the way it is. And you cannot have racism without American democracy. That's where it all began and continues today. So the third thing that I appreciate, no, maybe the fourth thing I appreciate about this book is its truth-telling. You know a lot here at CJP and at EMU about truth-telling. It's often associated with restorative justice. So is truth listening. Before we can transform a harm, we've got to admit it and tell the whole truth about it. And listen to the whole truth about it. Though obviously this book is not part of a restorative process, Between the World and Me functions as a powerful act of truth-telling about historically silenced realities, particularly about what it means to live in a black body, a body that legal authorities are licensed to plunder, a body that was tortured and exploited during slavery and segregation, a body that continues to be assaulted and terrorized through mass incarceration and police killings today. Though the book is styled as a letter to Coates' 15-year-old son, its exquisite truth-telling is directed to white people. Its deep talking evokes deep listening. It is an eye-opener, a revelation, particularly for white people, about what it is like to inhabit a black male body. You get an intimate, up-close look with reading this book. White people get to live in his skin. His writing is so powerful in that way. It pulls you in. As we say in the RJ tradition, in the RJ movement, to truly listen is to risk being changed forever. And I think that white people are truly listening to Coates, and they are being changed by reading his book. And I appreciate that profoundly. But as you might imagine, for black people, the story is nothing new. Black people already know these truths only too well. through their lived experiences over decades and centuries. Now let's move to my five concerns. I just talked about four really wonderful things about the book. First, the book suggests that racism is permanent, offering no vision for a way forward. Coates says movements against racism and spirituality offer false hope. He tells his son, and I quote, "We black people are captured and surrounded by the, quote, majoritarian American bandits with little hope of escape." My second concern is the book's obsession with the body. Coates deconstructs race as a falsehood and as an invention of modernity. Yet in believing that only the body is real and only matter matters, he falls prey to another modern invention, and that is materialism. This imposes, needless to say, an enormous limitation on his vision of what is possible. My third concern is with the book's individualism. The title, "Between the World and Me," is a laconic and vivid expression of the individualistic orientation of the book. Doesn't it conjure up the image of the whole world on one side and one person, one individual on the other? Between the world and me, me, me. It is remarkable to me that though the book was written in response to the police killings of unarmed black men and women that have captured international headlines since Trayvon Martin and Michael Brown, Coates does not even mention the historically unprecedented and massive youth-driven movement for black lives that arose to challenge the carnage. To me, this is akin to writing an account of the appalling injustices of the civil rights movement without mentioning the mass movements that have been organized to contest and challenge these injustices. The exaltation of the individual above the community emerged in the 1500s with the rise of modernity. And this was all part of the enormous historical shift represented by the rise of Europe, the founding of modern nation states and empires, the conquista, and the onset of African slavery and racial capitalism. Individualism is an invention of modernity, no less than race is. Individuals or superheroes are not the drivers of human transformation or history. Social movements are. Even though Martin Luther King was a leading figure of his era, his power came from the masses of people whose aspirations and dreams he articulated and advocated for. Though Mahatma Gandhi and Nelson Mandela are revered leaders, their power arose from the fact that they spoke for millions of people, organized and galvanized in massive social movements. We are learning from indigenous cultures about the importance of having a relational worldview rather than an individualistic one. In Africa, the traditional watchword is Ubuntu. I am who I am only because of my relationship with you, with all humans, and with all inhabitants of this earth. In Mayan tradition, it is In Lakesh. I am the other you. In Lakota Sioux tradition, it is Mitaki Oyasin. We are all related. We are all relatives. Individualism, especially when coupled with materialism, denies our inherent interrelatedness. Just because we can't see the connections, the ties that bind all of us, it doesn't mean they don't exist. Cultural historian Charlene Spretnak has said, and I quote, "It is a massive denial of our inherent interrelatedness that is the ultimate cause of interspecies and intraspecies disaster." Should I say that again? The massive denial of our inherent interrelatedness is the ultimate cause of interspecies and intraspecies disaster. The idea that we are solipsistic, atomistic individuals moving through space, only bumping into one another once in a while, rather than acknowledging this inherent interrelatedness that the ancients knew about. And briefly, my fourth and final concern about the book is that it's silent on capitalism, yet another invention of modernity. Dr. Cornel West elaborates on this critique in some of his reviews of Coates' work. It's a huge fallacy to ignore global capitalism as a force that is the historical source of racism and today is driving all the suffering on our planet. So during the 19th century, earlier part of the 19th century, that is, many people could not imagine a world without slavery. It was a given. It was a built-in feature of this nation and who we were. It took a social movement, the abolitionists, to imagine and manifest that new world without slavery. Today in the 21st century, many people, Ta-Nehisi Coates included, cannot imagine an America without racism. But I tell you today, I am seeing, and others are also seeing, the glimmers of a new day. In our country and beyond, we are more aware today than ever before of police killings and black men and women. And for this, by the way, we must give props to the youth of Ferguson. After Michael Brown was killed, those young people stayed out on the streets in protest, stayed out on the streets, quitting their jobs, losing their homes, living in their cars, for a period of time that was almost the longest demonstration in recent history, with the exception of the Montgomery bus boycott. They stayed out there until the whole world stood up and took notice. And the world did take notice. Today, no police killing can occur without there being international headlines. Though we are aware of racialized police killings and mass incarceration in America today in a way that we have never been before, we are not aware of the nature and extent of the trailblazing anti-racism action that is bubbling up over this nation, all over this nation, like never before. There, for example, is Surge showing up for racial justice. This is a national organization of white activists who are deeply dedicated to, first of all, eradicating their own racism. They are deeply committed to examining the ways in which they might be carriers of this historical racism and eradicating it. They understand that it's not just about helping black people. It's not just about altruism. It's about reclaiming their own humanity. Serge, there's probably a chapter close by. Is there? Does someone know?
Charlottesville.
So there are about 200 chapters across the nation, and this organization has been mushrooming and growing dramatically since President Trump was elected. They understand that though they are not responsible for creating this mess, for creating this system of racism. They must do something about it. They are responsible to do something, because not to do anything is to allow the default to be perpetuated. And that default, of course, is racism. White people are telling the truth about their ancestors' complicity with slavery and with lynchings like never before. It kind of started here, really, at EMU, you know, with the Coming to the Table Project. How many of you know about the Coming to the Table Project? Excellent. Yeah. Where the DeWolf, one of the members of the DeWolf family discovered in her adulthood, she never heard these stories growing up. These were silenced truths. She found that her family was the largest slave trading dynasty in this country, in this country's history. And she was so devastated when finding out about that, and when realizing that she never heard that before as a child. So she responded by creating a film called Traces of the Trade, which tells the truth about her family's complicity with the slave trade. And she shares it far and wide, all over the world, all over this country, and engages in racial healing dialogue after, and also in dialogue about taking action about what can be done. Tom DeWolf, a relative of Catherine, helped to start the Coming to the Table Project, which brings together descendants of slaves with descendants of slave owners, to engage in racial healing dialogue and collective action. Karen Brannon, a journalist, is also telling the truth. She wrote a book. She's out of CJP as well in the Coming to the Table Project. Universities all over are studying their roots, exposing and telling the truth about their complicity in the slave trade and in slavery. Harvard, Yale, Brown, Georgetown, right here, University of Virginia. There is an organization called University Studying Slavery, which is growing by leaps and bounds every year, where they are creating commissions to tell the truth about the way they've benefited from the sale of slaves. Harvard actually removed its official shield because it contained the family crest of a slave owner by the name of Isaac Royale. Harvard also changed the name of one of its buildings from the name of a slave-owning president to the names of the slaves who worked in that building for that president. Harvard has also recently erected a memorial to the slaves who toiled to make Harvard what it is today. I can go on and on. This is a wonderful thing that's happening all over. It's like a spark that's lit a prairie fire. It's happening all over the country. We don't know about it. That's what I mean. We know about the killings, but we don't know about these reparative actions that are being taken. Do you know about Equal Justice Initiative? That's another example of the truth-telling that's happening. Yeah? Raise your hand if you know about Bryan Stevenson and the Equal Justice Initiative. I would suggest that Just Mercy, a book that was written by Bryan Stevenson, become the next common read. Bryan Stevenson is next week opening up a lynching museum, the nation's first ever. He first issued a report, released a report 2 years ago, 3 years ago, which is available online for free. And in studying lynchings, he saw that across the nation, especially in the South, the landscape is dotted with memorials to Confederate generals, and with few, if any, memorials to those who have lost their lives to lynching, to the martyrs of the liberation struggle for Black people. So he determined that he was going to change this. He's been to a lot of lynching sites and laid plaques and memorials. He's also taken the soil from a lot of these lynching sites, put them in bottles, and he brought them back to Montgomery, where they sit on shelves inside of the lynching museum. And some of that soil has been mixed with the cement that was used to construct the lynching museum. Go there if you can. If not next week, then perhaps next summer. And then, you know, of course, you all know about all of the Confederate memorials that are coming down all across the nation. It kind of started with the Charleston Nine when the flags came down, and it hasn't stopped since, especially after Charlottesville and the killing of Heather Heyer. So hundreds of memorials are coming down. Many jurisdictions across the nation, not just in the South, are having discussions and often heated debates about bringing down Confederate memorials. So in my almost 60 years, yeah, 60 years, I'm an old lady, I guess. In all my almost 60 years of activism, I have never seen so much anti-racism activism, and especially so much truth-telling. I have never seen so many white people involved in this truth-telling. So in closing, I would urge that we read more books like Coates. Even with its limitations, the storytelling is so powerful, and the empathy it evokes may be life-altering, as I said earlier. Learn more about the pseudoscientific notion of race and how it originated with capitalism. Do more common reads on this subject at EMU. Just Mercy was one example that I mentioned a moment ago. Beyond common reads, develop curricula, not just for a class in Black or Africana studies, but following the lead of Germany's Holocaust curricula, infuse curricula that tells the truth about slavery in art classes, in psychology classes, in restorative justice, in music classes, in development classes, in peace building, in all the classes. That's the way they're doing it in Germany. Challenge yourself to be a healer of historical harms, a healer of historical harms, and an activist for justice. We need not just structural change to create a future without racism. We need a lot of internal transformational work, all of us. Imagine, exercise that muscle of imagining a country that is not racially fractured. For imagination is the first step to realization and manifestation. Learn more about the work that's happening at universities. Learn more about the work that's happening at EJI in Montgomery. Learn more about coming to the table's racial healing process, the racial dialogue process. And then on the subject of hope, while Coates declaims false hopes, I believe that though this is a time of victory of a U.S. president who was a billionaire and has created a cabinet of billionaires, the 1%, this is a time of victory of a racist, an Islamophobe, a homophobe, a misogynist, a xenophobe. I wish I could say that this is exaggeration, but it's not. A transphobe and a climate change denier in the White House. But let us not forget that it is also a time of activism that is bubbling up with energy and power all over, the likes of which we have not seen historically. And in the sense that though the poison is very much present, we also have the makings of the antidote. This is also a time of great hope. And on the subject of hope, be the hope. Be the hope, as Dr. Cornell West has said, for us in these times to even have hope is too abstract. It's too detached. It is too spectatorial. Instead, we must be hope. Be an active participant and a force for good as we face this catastrophe. Thank you.
Thank you.